good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you. My name's Bridget Fitzgerald. You're listening to The Country Hour. I hope you're well on this Tuesday. Now, I could have sworn that it was a bad idea to feed chocolate to animals. I'm not sure if that's just what I had drilled in to me as a child, not allowed to feed any chocolate to the dog. But apparently, it's not such a bad idea when it comes to cattle. You're going to hear a little bit later on how one Wagyu producer has been making waves with his product by allowing the animals to have a bit of a tasty treat. More on that coming up for you in the second half of the program today. 0448 922 604 is the text line number. Do get in touch with me. Let me know what you're up to, what's going on. Feel free to have your say on any of our stories throughout the program. To kick off, though, we're going to take a look at, well, we talk about it a lot, but that booming market to China. Because in just 12 months, a winery in Denmark on the south coast has seen a growth of about $250,000 in sales of wine to China. Rockcliffe Winery is one of the largest wineries in that great southern region and has existing export markets in Singapore and Malaysia, as well as China. But the owner and manager, Steve Hall, only really started making a big push into trade shows in China in the past year, and the results have been almost instantaneous. Unless you've actually been over there to those trade shows in China, they're really like nothing you've ever seen. Some 250,000 people will attend a trade show in a single day. 250,000 people in one day. Well, Steve Hall, what have you learned about growing your market in China?
The key thing really is to go to China and meet up with potential buyers. It's a little bit different doing things in China than it is doing things in other countries, because the meetings have to be kind of arranged. If you go to a wine show in Australia, you meet people, people taste the wine and they buy the wine or they don't buy the wine. But in China, you spend more time with people who you have arranged already to go to the wine show. And then you might sit down with them and then you have a chat and then you sort of get to know them a little bit better. It's difficult, of course, for me to chat because I don't speak Chinese. And so the way that we do it is we have an agent who knows the various potential buyers, and they arrange the wine shows and they arrange the people to go to the wine shows. And then I have a chat with them, or I just say hello and have my photograph taken with them, which seems to be, having your photograph taken seems to be a key part of the meeting. And then, okay, you kind of get to know them, and then the next wine show you might meet them again, and then you might go to another wine show and you might meet them again. And eventually, once you've developed a relationship with them, then you might make a sale.
And how long has it been since, well, you started actually making a concerted effort to show up and meet people at these trade shows?
Well, a concerted effort was I started doing that a year ago. But the first year we didn't do so much. This last 12 months we've done a lot more. And I think I have another two trade shows to go to this year.
And then in that 12-month period, how significant has the increase in those sales been?
It does make a big difference. It's been quite marked, the amount. I don't know what the percentage would be, but the increase has been, substantial. And again, it's just about getting to know people. It's also about getting to know the agent as well, So the agent commits to selling a certain amount of wine. And that's where it comes from.
At this stage, what kind of proportion of your wine are you selling overseas, and particularly to that Asian Chinese market, and what proportion would you be selling locally?
Well, we sell wine currently to Malaysia, Singapore and China. We're currently looking at selling it in Myanmar, India, Philippines, Japan, Korea, Ireland, UK. So we're looking at a lot of other places, and it takes a bit of time to get through to it. But I would say we would sell maybe 30 or 40% internationally.
And what kinds of wine in particular do you think are popular in that Chinese market?
Chinese is really Shiraz. That's it.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, it's got, yeah. I mean, it's red wine for sure. I mean, they like Cabernet Merlot. They kind of like Cabernet. But they do like Shiraz. Or the Shiraz Cabernet. We do sell that to them.
Why do you think that is?
The Chinese like red wine. I don't know why. And it's always rather peculiar. I mean, when I say the Chinese, I also mean the Chinese in Malaysia, the Chinese in Singapore. You know, we'll sell 90% of the wine that we sell to them is red.
There's often been talk of the difference in tastes between maybe the Chinese or Asian customers as perhaps Australia domestic customers. Is there any push or pressure to change the taste of any of your wine products, or is it a case that it's easy enough to sell as they are?
Well, I think we have to sell the wine that they want. We can't just put the same wine in the bottle for the Chinese as perhaps would be appropriate for the Perth CBD, for example. It's not. I don't think it works. I think we have to make wine for China.
How much emphasis and more effort, I guess, will you be putting on that Chinese market, and how important is that market to wineries like you, particularly in WA and on that south coast?
Well, it's such a large market, really. I would say it's becoming increasingly more important to us. It's almost like we have to treat China as a completely separate business. So we have to, you know, maybe diversify in China. There are so many wine drinkers in China that the focus really has to be there. I mean, you know, there are wine drinkers in Malaysia, and they do like high-quality wine, but the numbers are, you know, the population, for example, of Malaysia is about the same as Australia, which is like 27, 30 million people. But you can go to China, and the population of one city is 27 million people. You actually can sell an enormous amount of wine to one city, which is like the same size as Malaysia. So you see, China effectively can be an absolutely major part of the business.
Thanks for your time, Steve Hall. He's the owner and manager of Rockcliffe Winery in Denmark. That's on the south coast. They've got about $250,000 sales, or sales have increased by $250,000 into that Chinese market just by making a concerted effort at trade shows. It's always good to, and you can actually calculate those kinds of results. And they said it couldn't be done. But after more than a decade of trying, an international team of researchers have uncovered genes resistant to sclerotinia. The fungal disease costs West Australian canola producers around $59 million annually by causing plants to wilt and to ripen prematurely. Now, scientists at the University of Western Australia and Punjab Agricultural University in India found 10 genes from wild brassica species that tested positive for resistance, and they've already started crossbreeding those genes into Indian mustard varieties. But Professor Martin Barbetti from UWA's School of Agriculture and Environment says that unless WA growers actually push for these genes to be crossed into cultivated canola varieties here at home, they might never see the light of day.
So what we found is that from Brassica fruticulosa, which is a wild weedy brassica, which is also present in Australia and present in India, when that was crossed with Brassica juncea, we're able to shift resistance, which the wild weedy species has naturally to sclerotinia, we could shift that into Brassica juncea. And then having done that, we're able to show why it was resistant, and actually we're able to identify 10 genes for resistance to sclerotinia.
So how significant is this?
Well, sclerotinia is a major disease worldwide, not just on canola, but also on mustard. mustard being a million hectare crop in places like India, and also on vegetable brassicas as well. So things like cabbage, cauliflowers, broccoli all get severe sclerotinia, not just canola. Put it into context, its importance in Western Australia, it's been estimated by the Department of Agriculture that there's about $59 million worth of canola which is lost from sclerotinia each year.
So where do you go to from here? What do you do with this information?
Well, what it does, it actually, for mustard crops, it's directly usable now. So in India, the resistance has been put into mustard and into the mustard crops, and so it will be used to control sclerotinia in India. But it also, it's very easy to cross mustard with true canola, which is the Brassica napus, and also to transfer it into that. And we have other resistances from the wild weedy species, which we've already had crossed straight into canola, and we've been able to show that some of those also have very good levels of resistance against sclerotinia.
So how long do you think it would be before growers here in Western Australia would be able to seed types of canola that do have this quite high resistance to sclerotinia?
I guess that's the component which is really out of our hands. So we can transfer these resistances into species, into mustard and into canola. But after that, it's really up to whether the breeding companies will run with that and produce resistant varieties for Australia. So currently we rely on chemicals for controlling sclerotinia. But the problem with chemicals is that in our farming systems, they are relatively expensive. You're looking at something like about $33 a hectare for the chemical and maybe another $7 a hectare for the spray. So about $40 per spray, and the recommendations are something like spray at 10 and 50% bloom. So you've got two sprays, you've got $80 a hectare. So if you have a sclerotinia problem, then that $80 a hectare is probably a good investment. But in many cases, people don't have a sclerotinia problem and they're still putting the chemical on, and that's just a huge loss out of their profits. And the problem is that you can't predict. There is no accurate prediction mechanism in Australia to predict which crops will actually have the sclerotinia and which ones won't. So they try to measure the level of infestation of the petals with sclerotinia, but the reality is, yes, you can measure that, but it doesn't relate well at all to the level of sclerotinia that you get on the stems and causing stem collapse. So chemicals are really not a long-term. So short-term, they're fine. Long-term, they're not really an option. So that leaves us with cultural controls. Sclerotia of the pathogen persists for a very long time. We use minimum tillage systems so we don't bury them anyway, and the pathogen's got a huge host range. It's very happy on capeweed, it's happy on lupins or other legume crops. So it really only leaves you resistant varieties. It's the only economic sustainable long-term control for sclerotinia. And the resistances that we've found and shown in the work, particularly with India, those resistances are being picked up now and used in Europe and in North America and other countries around the world.
So for growers to actually make this a reality, to get their hands on some of this resistant varieties, Professor, I mean, what has to happen? Where does this push have to come from?
I think the push in many ways has to come from growers themselves. The funding organisations listen to growers, and the research organisations also today are very responsive to growers. And if growers start to say they know that there is resistance available and they want that in their varieties, then I think that's how you're going to see varieties in Australia, particularly for Western Australia, which are going to have good resistance to sclerotinia.
So it sounds like this research really does have worldwide implications, and hopefully one day it'll get to Western Australia for growers here.
Oh, I hope so. We perhaps need it more than many other countries. I mean, we're a very low input, low profit margin farming system compared to, say, Europe. We don't have subsidies like they have in Europe and in North America. So Australian farmers do it tough on the world market, and really need every advantage that they can have. And if they could have this advantage, it would make a huge difference to them in terms of their profitability of their canola, and also to be assured of having a profitable canola crop, not one that late in the season, when you've got a really good-looking crop, then gets devastated by sclerotinia.
Professor Martin Barbetti from UWA's School of Agriculture and Environment speaking there with Tara De Langraft. It's that familiar and I would hope probably comforting sound of the faithful dog. And for most of you listening, faithful working dog or farm dog that I know that are important parts of the team. This week on Country Hour, I'm calling on you to share your favourite photos of your working dogs. Coming up this Saturday, it's National Dog Day. Just celebrating the importance of these loving animals that are always by our side. And we want your photos so that we can add them to an album in time, WA Country Hour style. We would like your working dog photos, your best shots of your pups. You can send them to me on text line. I'll try and gather as many as I can. 0448 922 604 is the number. But the best place to share those working dog photos with us ahead of National Dog Day on Saturday will be the WA Country Hour Facebook page. So if you don't already, jump onto that page, like us, of course, because we always share fantastic content up there, and either send it in a private message or post it to the page. We'll be trying to keep a look at on who is the best photographer of their lovely working dog. 0448 922 604. If you'd like to send it in a message as well, we accept all forms. Someone on the text line, 0448 922 604, just touching on the increase of sales of wine to China for a Denmark winery, has said the Chinese prefer red wine because white wine is considered weak, red being the stronger of the two, and Merlot is also selling well into China as well. Thanks for those thoughts. 0448 922 604. With export prices booming and low numbers of seconds fruits for juicing, it's a good time to be an Australian orange grower. But a recent national shortage of juicing oranges meant imported fruit had to be used to make local orange juices, with some juicing brands only just resuming sales of 100% local product. So it seems that while a shortage of Valencia citrus for juicing is a win for the growers, it is causing headaches for processors in the juice business, as Tom Nancaro reports.
It's a hive of activity in citrus crops around the country, as tons of fruit is set to be harvested and packed. It's been a positive period for growers, with the opening of export markets and demand for fresh Aussie fruit high. But it has been a testing time for those in the juice industry. Earlier this year, the country was faced with a short supply of juicing oranges. It meant solid returns for growers, but the tightening of supply meant that Aussie juicing companies were turning to imported fruit from overseas. Daily Juice is one in particular who's labelled their product with stickers, indicating to consumers that their juice was being created using 100% imported fruit. Co-managing director of Nippies in the Riverland, Ben Nispel, said it has been a pretty tough time.
Nippies is a family business that my grandfather started in the 1930s. I've been heavily involved in, I guess, the senior management of it since 2008, and it's the first time, or the last year or two, has been the first time in that period where the juice factory is not making money, and the orchard, typically in my time, the orchards have been struggling and the juice factory's been going well, but it's certainly been the reverse the last 2 years.
On the flip side of this is the grower, who after years of struggles with Valencias have started to see benefit through increased prices. Sunland citrus grower Mark Dakey.
Last year we started off at a lower price, which the season was shaping up to be another average year, but come October, as Weld realised there was a shortage of frozen orange juice, the price for fresh fruit and fresh juice rose significantly.
How many years were you sort of tracking at a point where you were considering, do I continue on with the Valencias and do I mix up the varieties?
Well, last August, so 12 months ago, we had virtually decided to get rid of half of our Valencias, and we had actually started to top work some of our Valencias over to better paying varieties. But when the price went up in October, we stopped top working. And now we're going to wait and just see what happens.
But for now at least, it seems the tide has turned. In a statement made to the ABC, the Lion Group, the company that owns Daily Juice, says they returned to full production and using Aussie oranges 2 weeks ago, with new bottles hitting the shelves late last week. Ben Nispel from Nippies also says with the Valencia season just around the corner, he is cautiously optimistic.
There's certainly more Valencias on trees to harvest this year than what there was this time last year. I'm just wearing my juice hat for the moment. I'm certainly more positive about the year ahead than the year that's behind us. Having said that, our domestic market, growing market here, is on a global scale that small that even if we have got a few more oranges on the few trees that we've got, if there's global demand, we could be in trouble again. But at this stage, we're thinking positively about the year ahead.
But what the future holds remains quite up in the air. Citrus Australia CEO Judith Damiani says that as more growers try navels and Valencias to crack international markets, it could be an all too common situation to see more foreign fruit in Aussie juice.
Well, I think that the issue with supply of juicing oranges will actually continue because what we're seeing is a long-term decline in Valencia production in particular. And that is really because it doesn't provide the returns that the growers are receiving from the other varieties. So many of them are just continuing to take those Valencia trees out.
That's Judith Damiani, CEO of Citrus Australia, speaking there with Tom Nancaro. It is 26 minutes past 12. Romance, hardship, European travel and a near-fatal illness. It sounds more like the ingredients to a movie plot than the history of an Australian organic farming pioneer, doesn't it? Tasmanian academic Dr. John Paul has uncovered the amazing story of the life of Eileen McPherson. John Paul came across the story of Eileen, Australia's first female organic farmer, when he was researching the beginnings of the organic movement.
I was at Oxford University and I was asked to do a history of Australian organics. I had a hunch that organics in Australia might have gone right back to the very beginning, and the beginning was Rudolf Steiner. Rudolf Steiner, in 1924, created at Kobowitz this entity called the Experimental Circle, and the full name, Experimental Circle of Anthroposophical Farmers and Gardeners. In the early days, it didn't have the name biodynamic farming, and it certainly didn't have the name organic farming. They both came later. So I'm rummaging through the archives, and what I'm finding is there's 12 Australians. There are Australians who joined the experimental circle, and the data is still there. Their paperwork that they have signed to say, yes, I'm applying to be a member of the experimental circle. One of those names was Eileen McPherson, and that's how I came across Eileen McPherson.
How did you follow that thread then?
Well, I followed it in a slightly tangential way, because right at the beginning of that list was Ernesto Giannone, which was a surprise because here we have an Italian. What is an Italian doing? And his membership of the experimental circle was the very first one from Australia, and he was there getting a German edition of the agriculture course before it even appeared in English. So Ernesto comes back to Australia. He talks about biodynamic farming, he talks about anthroposophy, and he meets Eileen. And so that's a romance there of this dashing young Italian artist. He was a very different kind of character than the Australians that Eileen was ever going to meet. And there was this romance. There was a problem about getting married because he had a very brief marriage in Italy and neither party would grant a divorce, and it didn't ever happen. So together, in any event, together they create a biodynamic farm called Demeter Farm, and that's in Dandenong.
So you think she's Australia's first woman organic farmer?
She's Australia's first woman organic farmer. It's very hard to find somebody who's before that, because we're talking way before the term organic agriculture happens. We're talking even before the term biodynamic farming happens, but we are talking after Rudolf Steiner.
Tell us about Demeter, the farm. Dandenong, you say?
Dandenong is, yes, there's a cemetery there now. So it was a mixed farm. It had there's animals and vegetables for it, and it was run for 20 years. And Eileen got sick along the way. She had pernicious anemia. So her story becomes interesting in the sense that if she had developed pernicious anemia a little bit earlier, she would have died really quickly. That's why it's pernicious, because it's deadly. But about the time that she developed it, which is about 1940, there was this idea of if we feed people raw liver, we can get them out of this pernicious anemia, we can resolve it. And so she spent some years in hospital. And when she came out, she was a very deteriorated woman. She couldn't walk and she had multiple issues. But it was her original idea to have this farm in Dandenong. She worked on it. She milked the cows, etc. She never travelled to what would be the spiritual home of biodynamics, which is Switzerland. And she never did that just because of her health.
Have you been able to look into her history before the great romance with Ernesto?
Before the great romance with Ernesto? Well, she went to Clyde School, which is now Geelong Grammar. It was an all-girls school. She excelled in every sport that the school engaged in. She won the award for the whole school one year. She was academically, she was good. She was a prefect. So she was very active. So this was a great tragedy when she got hit up with this pernicious anemia. On the other hand, she got hit up with pernicious anemia and just about everybody of that period would have died. But because she got all this treatment and because of this developing treatment, she went to live another 40 years, despite the fact that it was in a wheelchair.
Do you think there's some sort of a movie, a documentary? There's got to be some film told about this story, don't you think?
Well, she has an interesting story. She has an interesting life. She teamed up with a very interesting bloke. Ernesto has an incredible story as well. And she deserves some. Despite her disability, she continued to have this great interest in anthroposophy and biodynamic farming to support people who were doing it and to support people who had projects along that way. And she continues to do so even after her death because there's a legacy.
Dr. John Paul, almost cut him off there, research associate with the University of Tasmania, speaking with Sally Dacus. And the full story of Eileen McPherson is up on the website of Invisible Farmer. If you just type Invisible Farmer ABC into your search engine, you should be able to find it there. It's 28 minutes to 1 o'clock. Rebecca Dullery joins me in the studio for News Headlines.
Thanks, Bridget. The US President Donald Trump has used his first televised address to the nation to reverse a campaign pledge to withdraw from Afghanistan. Mr. Trump addressed the military at Fort Myer and his address was beamed across the country. He wouldn't give details of troop numbers, but he's reversing his campaign pledge to immediately withdraw from Afghanistan. The Social Services Minister, Christian Porter, has rejected claims that welfare recipients could be stigmatised by the government's new drug testing trial. The coalition will drug test about 5,000 job seekers in three different locations under the two-year trial. It's chosen the Canterbury-Bankstown Council area in Western Sydney as the first trial location. And Deputy Opposition Leader Tanya Plibersek says demands for Labor MPs to show proof they're not dual citizens are unfounded and a bridge too far. The Shadow Attorney-General, Mark Dreyfus, claims Liberal MP Anne Sotomalis needs to clarify her citizenship. In turn, the government's named a number of Labor MPs it says have questions to answer. Thanks, Bridget. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much. Rebecca Dullery there with the news headlines. And I want to know from you on the text line 0448 922 604. What would you call the meat from cows that are fed chocolate? If livestock was fed chocolate, what would you call that meat? You're going to hear about a Wagyu producer who's found that it's been quite successful to the taste of his product. You'll hear why shortly, but we're just trying to do a bit of marketing on that idea. So 0448 922 604. You can head to our Facebook page as well. That's WA Country, our Facebook page, to let us know what you would call meat from cows that are fed chocolate. But more importantly, let's check in with the weather now. Noel Pusey is there ready to go. Noel, what can we expect across the South West Land Division?
Afternoon, Bridget. Yeah, we've got a weak front moving over the southwest corner as we speak. There's not very much in it. Some very light showers of drizzle essentially over the southwest district up into the southern parts of the lower west and across the south coastal district at the moment. And those showers will extend for a period to the sort of western great southern and along the south coast into the southeast coastal district this afternoon and evening before contracting to near southern coastal parts overnight. And then during Wednesday, really, the showers continue along the south coast and also the Eucla coast as a sort of weak ridge starts to develop south of the state. And we might see a shower or two, some very light stuff through parts of the Great Southern and maybe southern parts of the Goldfields for a period during the day tomorrow. But again, very light falls in that. And then during Thursday, the ridge still continues to very slowly develop. Showers continue along the south coast, Albany to, Cape Lewin to Islay Bay on Thursday. And then during Friday, similar story for both Friday and Saturday, the ridge doesn't really move into the Bight too much anymore. And we're just looking at southern and Eucla coast showers really through, probably mostly in the mornings on both Friday and Saturday. And the rest of the division looks pretty good for the next 4 days. There's fairly dry conditions and a chance to warm up a little bit over the Wednesday through to Saturday period there as the temperatures start to rise just a little bit.
Anything to report for northern and eastern districts there, Noel?
There's a little bit there. There's some mid-level cloud still continues down from the sort of Carnarvon Exmouth region across the central Gascoyne to the interior. There could be some very light falls in that over the next day or two. It sort of thickens up a little bit during Thursday night into Friday and then extends through the southern interior into the northern nucleus. So we might see some patchy rain develop over the southern interior essentially and maybe the northern goldfields. But again, falls until at least Friday will be very light through there, but there might be just some moderate falls in the southern interior on Friday before it starts to clear a little bit east on Saturday.
And warnings, Noel?
The only warnings we have for coastal waters for tomorrow along the west coast between Shark Bay and Kalbarri, the sea breeze in the afternoon will pick up to around about 25 to 30 knots, so there's a warning out for that.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bridget.
Noel Pusey there, duty forecaster with the Weather Bureau, and Richard Hudson has joined me in the studio to read through the rainfall in the 24 hours to 9 a.m.
Yeah, not much to get through, actually. Nothing in the northern and eastern districts and nothing over 0.2 of a mil for the central west or the lower west. Actually, that's a lie. There's some that are around 2 mils. And then in the southwest, Cape Lewin 13, Kawarumup 7, Carey Valley Research Station 6, Margaret River 10, Northcliff 7, Walpole Forestry 8. In the southern coastal region, Jeremungup had 6 mils over 3 days. Kojanup's obviously had a fair bit of rain in recent times. We've got a fantastic photo up on Facebook of a tractor stuck right up to the axles, and it might take a few years to get that one out, I reckon. In the central wheat belt, nothing over half a mil, and the same for the Great Southern region, so not much there either.
And any ideas, Richard, on any names for the meat from cows fed chocolate?
Yeah, it's an interesting story that we're about to hear with some cows being fed some leftover scraps of choc milk. We've heard of choc milk, but what do you end up with when you're feeding chocolate to cows? Evidently, it changes the flavour of the beef, but I've come up with cacao.
Is that really yours?
No, it was Beck's. Okay.
Thank you to Richard Hudson.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Rebecca Dollery coming up with the goods on the marketing for that chocolate meat. And another one I've got through here on the text line. Now, forgive me, I'm not sure if it's Choc Milk Bobby from B in Gero or Choc Milk Bobby B in Gero. Or just choc milk from Bobby B. But thank you for that input there. 0448 922 604. And Owen in Bruce Rock says, meat from cows that are fed chocolate, bloody fattening. Well, that's probably some truth in that as well. Thanks for that, Owen. 0448 922 604. You can let me know what you think.
Most Australian farmers would be hard-pressed to remember a time without ABC Rural.
Voice of the Bush, a new book looking at the remarkable history of the ABC's Rural Department by historian Rob Lynn.
ABC Rural is the oldest continual agricultural broadcasting service anywhere in the world. I really think you're a mob of heroes.
Based on oral histories with ABC staff working on iconic programs like The Country Hour, A Big Country and Landline.
This is probably one of my favourite parts of the day, actually.
Available now from ABC Shops Online.
It is 20 minutes to 1 o'clock. It's a pleasure to be with you. My name's Bridget Fitzgerald. You are listening to The Country Hour. Our text line number is 0448 922 604. An online database for land managers is being delivered to help map out where weeds are and where they aren't in the Pilbara. The CSIRO is working with Parks and Wildlife on the Pilbara Weeds Database, aptly named, to help catalogue not only where weeds can be found and their abundance there, but also where they're likely not to be found, which helps weed managers develop targeted approaches. Michelle Stanley spoke with CSIRO research scientist Bruce Webber, who says while the weed databases currently available are helpful, they don't in fact go deep enough.
ultimately, this whole project is about improving the efficiency and effectiveness of weed management. I think everybody understands that we have fairly limited funds for weed management. So how can we make that dollar go further? We are very confident that by having a much better understanding of weed distribution in the Pilbara, we're going to be making a huge inroads into making that management more efficient. So from where we started 2.5 years ago of 800 records, we now have well over 700,000 records on weeds right across the Pilbara. And so we, I guess you can say from that, we've dramatically changed the understanding of where weeds are.
What kind of impact does that have? I mean, knowing there are a lot more out there, what will that do for the future of weed management?
So weed management is based on two things. Firstly, you need to understand where a weed is. And secondly, you need to understand what impact it's having in that area. And once you have those two pieces of knowledge, you can then understand how to prioritise those weeds for what is essentially a limited management budget, time and money. And so what we're doing is we're addressing that first aspect. We're addressing the knowledge about where weeds are. And so going, you can imagine from a database of 800 points to over 700,000 points, we've totally changed the understanding of where weeds are. But we're going beyond just the traditional data that's collected on species records. Usually what is recorded is just where a species is and what date. What we're also collecting is information on potentially the abundance at that area, and we're also collecting records where a species was not, so null records, evidence that a weed was potentially once there but not there now. And from a management perspective, if you're trying to understand how to manage a weed, that sort of data is also really useful.
Did it surprise you to have such a difference in the numbers of the weeds that had been recorded compared with what you've found from, I mean, really you haven't even gone through everyone's records, it's just the few records you have had available?
It is surprising, but it's not surprising either. And what's been really nice is that we're really riding a rapidly rolling snowball at the moment. At the moment, we're just doing a roadshow around the Pilbara, showcasing a first draft of the data and its analysis. And after every talk, we're having people come up to us and say, look, we see a hole in your data. That hole corresponds to data that we have. Can we provide you with our data? And I think the simple answer is absolutely yes. And really, that's the message that I'd like to put out today. If you feel that you have weed data that may or may not be available to the broad public, we would love to hear from you. We're particularly interested in data that we may not have already to cover holes in the database. Now, holes can be spatial, so we can have places where we have very little data from, or holes can be temporal. And so some of those really golden data sets are the very old weed data sets. Some of the data sets that may show the first appearance of a weed in the Pilbara. And if we can put those two aspects together, change in space and change in time, then we can identify weeds that are changing across the landscape. For us, that's the most important thing about this. Many people manage weeds in the Pilbara just based on their own tenure. But as we know, weeds don't obey tenure boundaries, they don't obey bioregion boundaries, and they don't even obey state boundaries. So if we're actually able to manage weeds on a much broader scale, we're going to get far better management outcomes, and that can only come from sharing data.
And what's the future of this project? You've only got a few months left before it sort of ends as such. What's next?
We've got to tick our boxes up to now, so that involves convincing other people that pulling weed data together is a useful thing to do, and we're hopefully going to have some analyses out at the end of the year that proves that beyond a doubt. The next stage is where to from here? In regards to moving on, there's a strong need to go beyond just the Pilbara, and where do we go next in the state is a very good question. Do we go to the whole of the state? Do we go to the whole of the nation? Those are questions that are probably well worth addressing in the new year.
Bruce Weber is a senior research scientist with CSIRO, and he was speaking there with Michelle Stanley. And that database is hoped to go online early next year, so early 2018. And on the text line, 0448 922 604, lots of your ideas for what to call the meat from cattle-fed chocolate. And I'll get to all of those in just a moment when we hear about this Wagyu story, where the Wagyu producer has been feeding chocolate to his stock. But another photo has come through. This is from Gary. Black and tan kelpie, about 3 months old, Steve. And it's a gorgeous shot. I am asking for your photos of your working dogs, your favourite photos, or just a photo of your favourite dog, if you like. It doesn't even have to be your favourite photo, because we want to put an album together ahead of National Dog Day, which is this Saturday. Any excuse to just have a look at a few cute puppies we're quite happy with. You can send them to me on the text line 0448 922 604. We can download them for there and share them on our album, or just head to our Facebook page. That's the WA Country Hour Facebook page, where we're also going to collect them and put them all into an album. So go on, show off your pet. 0448 922 604. The world's first physical sale of pole Wagyu genetics attracted widespread interest at the weekend. 20 young bulls were offered for sale and averaged $9,000 a head. Lara Webster reports that vendors were happy with the results as they tested out the market for interest.
A syndicate of three parties put up the 20 12-month-old purebred bulls for auction in North Queensland. They were the progeny of an American sire, and the top price paid was $15,000 for a young male, which weighed in at 376 kilograms. Tasmanian Wagyu breeder Keith Hammond was part of the syndicate and says he was pleased with the interest shown.
Very well received. Their condition couldn't have been any better. They were in good order. And we were really happy with how they were presented. We see the market going forward as being quite large for polled bulls, and particularly as we get more performance-based bulls on the market. We're very happy with the bulls we're producing. Any of those bulls we sold, we'd be happy to use in our own herd.
Wagyu beef is renowned for its marbling and premiums paid by the food service. But what's so special about these particular bulls? Well, it's simple. They're naturally polled, which means they never develop horns. Dehorning cattle is a controversial issue in the industry. With some concerned, it is a painful procedure, which should be the subject of tighter regulation. Keith Hammond says that's why refining pole Wagyu genetics right now is paramount for the industry, particularly from an animal welfare point of view.
The pole genetics in all breeds of cattle is becoming more looked at, and there's more interest every year in producing cattle that make the management of the cattle easier, but also from an occupational health and safety, and just the looking after the animals, having the polled animals is going to be very important.
That's a sentiment Queensland breeder Darren Hemblin agrees with. He's one of the members of the syndicate.
Well, the reason we were all into Wagyu in the first place is for their carcass attributes. We believe that the future is going to mean that we're going to have to do something about our dehorning practices, and starting with poles is the simplest way to manage that problem. The pole Wagyu derived from the Wagyu breed, and we had to infuse Angus, pole Angus, into them generations back, so they're sitting at around 96% plus Wagyu. And that was the only way we could bring pole into the breed, because it is a horn breed.
And it seems the pole gene is not the only favourable attribute the breeders are noticing.
Well, as it's turned out, the bull we've used throws progeny that have very good temperament. And it's one of the attributes we're really looking for. With the polled Wagyu, we're wanting to produce cattle that produce good females for a good cow herd, but also produce steers that are going to perform in long feeding programs. So we're sort of trying to get a very balanced animal, and the temperament is very noticeable in these cattle compared to other cattle and even other Wagyu that we've worked with.
One issue that always comes up with bulls and the sales of bulls is once they're sold and they might move to a new state or a new climate, some bulls really struggle to acclimatise. How do the Wagyu or the pole Wagyu stack up in terms of their acclimatisation to new areas they go to?
the Wagyu have been surprising because in Japan they're a breed that's housed and kept in close proximity to each other, and they don't tend to be in the open ranges. But they've combined particularly well in Australia in the northern herds with the Bos Indicus in crossing. They've combined very well. They seem to adapt to the conditions extremely well, and there's a lot of those cattle being bred now.
That's Wagyu breeder Keith Hammond ending that report from Lara Webster. And you can see some photos of those bulls that were sold at that sale up online if you just search ABC Rural. Now, you've heard of pampered cattle before. Massages and pedicures designed to keep the animal's muscles tender before slaughter. But one station is taking happy beef to a new level by feeding chocolate to their cattle. Station owner Scott De Bruin has set up a tasting room on his property and exports luxury beef, which has been praised across the world, most recently by CNN, the news network, and BBC for its unique sweetness. Jemima Burt reports. Oompa, oompa,
I'm no Charlie Bucket, but we're standing next to about 10 tonnes of chocolate, destined for cattle feed. It smells something like Mars bar cheesecake mixed with dung.
Okay, so we're in a feed bunker. So what we've got here is it's a blend. So it's a bit of a proprietary blend, if you like. So we've got a few M&Ms, some Smarties, a few blocks of chocolate. We've also got some broken up crushed chocolate, we've got some biscuit meal, all sorts of delicious goodies.
Scott De Bruin is a cattle farmer from near Millicent in South Australia's southeast. He uses leftover chocolate from a nearby factory to feed his Wagyu herd.
To be brutally honest, it's something we really stumbled across. So we were looking for a product which was high in energy and high in fat to help us finish the cattle. And we started feeding chocolate to the cattle, and our customers started to tell us that our beef had this really unique flavour and was quite different to anything else they were tasting in the marketplace. And it just flowed on from there.
What is the flavour?
Well, it makes the beef quite sweet and also gives it a nutty undertone in the flavour.
The feed is part of a fattening strategy for the luxury beef created at Mayura Station.
They don't just eat chocolate. That's pretty important to understand because when people hear that we feed our cattle chocolate, don't think that that's the only thing they have in their diet. So it's still quite a balanced diet.
Do you ever get tooth decay in your cattle?
No, they don't have diabetes.
The station has received a lot of international attention recently, from CNN to the BBC. So why all the hype for this obscurely located tourist attraction? The station supplies restaurants across Asia and have their own tasting room on site.
So obviously welcome to the tasting room. My name is Mark, I'm the sort of chef and manager here, and we've got Megan over there.
Mark Wright is the chef at Mayura Station's tasting room.
So sometimes there's some confusion out there in the marketplace about, you know, what is this Wagyu stuff, you know, what's it all about? So Wagyu itself is the breed of cattle, and it's a Japanese breed. So obviously the only place in the world that Wagyu genetics have evolved is in Japan. And in fact, the literal translation of Wagyu is wa being Japanese and gyu meaning cow.
So in a cooking process, these unsaturated fats have a very low melting point. So we're looking at about 28 degrees Celsius. So imagine you've got a steak that has got the marbling running through the meat.
Guests come from across Australia and the world to try this beef.
So today we have the 9 plus marble score Wagyu, and we don't have that in Melbourne. The highest marble score I had is 8 and 7. So
you can taste the sweetness from it. In every course you could definitely taste the sweetness. It's really good.
What do you think people in London can learn from our Australian Wagyu?
Give up the fish and chips.
But don't be fooled. This steak might set you back more than your golden ticket.
If we look out the window and see a Wagyu cow standing in the paddock, how much is that cow worth?
a good amount.
Oompa, oompa, loompa, oompa-dee-doo.
Station owner Scott De Bruin ending that story from Jemima Burt. And on the text line, a couple of your ideas for names coming through for what that Wagyu would be called. Though the first text message is more of a technical one. I bet cows who are being fed chocolate would have a paddock full of very happy dung beetles. I'll leave that to your imagination. Vern has actually said, won't that cause mad cow disease? Now, from what I've just read on a vet's website, the cow gets BSE by eating feed contaminated with parts that come from another cow that was already sick. So the contaminated feed contains the abnormal prion and the cow becomes infected with that abnormal part when it eats the feed. So from what we can read, I don't think that the chocolate being fed would actually cause any mad cow's disease issues there. BSE is mad cow's disease in that reference there. But a couple of your lighter text messages on names for that meat produced by the cattle eating chocolate. Dairy moo is one suggestion on the text line. John says carob moo. I like that one, John. Thanks for that. PK simply says, could it be called cheat? Probably would be a good one as well. A couple of snacks all in one go. 0448922604 is the text number.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, President Trump reveals the United States' new strategy for Afghanistan. Could it see more Australian troops putting their lives at risk in the region? We look at the economic consequences of this year's record flu season and the part played by Lebanese authorities in foiling an alleged plot to blow up an airliner flying out of Sydney.
There is a recognition that the threat posed by Islamic-based terrorism or jihadi terrorism is increasingly seen as transnational. These individuals are operating both on the physical realm and in the virtual realm.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
Time to check in now with the Mushay sheep sale today. There were 13,000 sheep sold at Mushay today, and that's up big jump, 5,400 on last week. John Testro, people must be chasing those good prices.
Well, I think so. We probably talked it up a bit too much last week, the weather's a bit better and a bit kinder, and people get out and grab them. Total yarding of 13,000 sheep and lambs today. As you said, that was up 5,400 in last week, and a lift in new season's lambs to hand, and a general lift in quality right through. Market eased $10 to $20 on air freight type lambs. It was $2 up on trade lambs and $5 on heavy lambs. Mutton remained firm, as did wethers and old rams. The increased yarding in new season's lambs pen comprised nearly 2,000 head and sold from $40 to $73 for the very immature to feeders. And they use $5 to $10. On light air freight types at $75 to $110, they were back $5 to $10. The 20 to 22 kilo trade lambs comprised the bulk of the numbers, and they sold from $130 to $155 to be $2 dearer. Heavies made to $162. The old season's lambs continue to be the dominant numbers, however. Light old season's crossbred lambs to feeders sold from $25 to $65 to remain firm. Light lambs to air freight from $63 to $102, and they were back $15 to $20 on a greater supply. Trade weights were up $2 at $128 to $160, with the heavies at $159 to $175, up $5, and very much quality driven. Store Merino lambs, black tags, again met solid demand from feeders. The Merino ewe lambs made $46 to $70 for the very plain and light, the heavier to $123. Store Merino wethers, the lambs, they sold from $49 to $123 to feeder, and all were firm. Ram lambs were down in numbers, top selling from $90 to $162 to the trade, and lightweight to feeders at $35 to $65, again firm. Hoggets sold from $120 to $134 to the trade to remain firm. Mutton ewes were very erratic today, with the very light to feeders at $55. They were up $7, mediums to feeders from $50 to $110, and they were back $5 to $10. Better types remained firm, medium weight mutton to processors in the trade from $87 to $135, the latter with a big fleece. Heavy ewes made from $105 to $139, tops the game with a big fleece, and they were firm. Prime Weathers, they sold from $129 to $135 a head, with live exporters active at $100 to $118. Again, firm.
Thanks for that, John. It's time to get to the news now. It's 1 o'clock.